Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we're going to be talking about money. Yes, but we're going to be talking about money in a different way. In today's world, our economy has been going through a great many challenges. People are looking for options. They're wanting to know, what can I do? If I can't find a job, maybe I can find something I can do as an individual, an entrepreneur, so I can make money. What's your biggest challenge when you want to make money? Well, if you're starting a business, it's getting that money. My guest today, Charles Green, is a man who has put together a book called Get Financing Now. And what this is about is navigating through bankers, investors, and various sources to get the capital your business needs. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. It's great to be with you.
Now, I want my audience to know that your background has been very strongly associated with the Small Business Finance Institute in Atlanta, Georgia. When you were doing this, you have over 30 years of experience working with entrepreneurs. That in that time frame, I'm sure you've seen massive changes when it comes to trying to obtain capital, trying to be able to help those people in the small business environment succeed. And you have also worked as an executive director of the Small Business Finance Institute, and you've got all kinds of background. Everything from being a venture capitalist, being involved in banking yourself. You've worked with people from around the world, from different countries. When you put this together, because this is quite an extensive book, it must have taken you a good deal of time.
Well, only about 30 years to figure all that out and experience this.
Okay.
But actually, entrepreneurship started for me around the dinner table at home. I grew up in a family that owned and operated a small business. So I was at a board meeting every night for dinner.
Oh, dear.
And I learned a lot of valuable lessons there that my mother and father were talking about customer care and dealing with all kinds of issues and employees and taxes and cash flow and bank loans. My father had an SBA guaranteed loan. I never realized at the time that I would grow up to become an expert in SBA guaranteed loans.
A lot of people in dealing with the SBA get very, very frustrated. Here you've become quite a specialist with this. Give us a range of loans that you've worked with. Does it go as high as $20 million? Does it go as low as, let's say, $5,000. Tell us, what kind of money options does the SBA work with?
Well, the SBA can be $5,000, but remember, they don't loan money. They provide a credit enhancement to a bank. They don't even talk to small businesses. They are dealing with banks to create an environment that is more enticing for banks to make loans in the small business sector. Most SBA lending is probably in the range of $100,000 to the new high limit of $5 million.
Uh-huh. And you say that's a new high limit.
Yes. The Small Business Jobs Act of 2010 raised the ceiling from what had been $2 million for several years up to $5 million.
When someone in business is looking at gaining capital, you have really done, I think, an outstanding job in laying things out. A person who has had absolutely no background in working with financing, I think, would actually be quite comfortable with the book that you've put together. And you really go into quite a bit of detail on it, but knowing the financial range is a very good thing. You talk about with the small business that it accounts for more than 99% of all business entities in the United States. That is really something. That's a substantial, solid core of the economy, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And it creates something like 63% of all new jobs. It's 54% of the payrolls every week. And it is more than 70% of all new patents are filed by small businesses.
With those numbers, we are in a time when it's extremely difficult for people to get funding. We have had all kinds of financial fiascos with the banking industry, and there are individuals, when they go into a bank, they are really feeling intimidated. How would you recommend someone begin the process if they are looking at gaining capital? What would you say to them if they sat down right in front of you right now, Charles, and said, gee whiz, I'm thinking of starting a cookie company, and I'm using cookie because I like cookies so much, but, you know, they say, I'm wanting to do a cookie company, I've got Aunt Sarah's recipe, and this is what I want to do. How would you tell them to begin?
Well, the most important part is to, you know, align the purpose of the money with the appropriate source of funding. And that's what takes some content in the book, is where I explain in detail what more appropriate funding sources are. Everyone has an inclination to run down to the bank for everything, and in many cases, it's just not the appropriate place to get funding. A lot of other people think they're going to run out and find an investor. And investors are quite particular about the kinds of deals that they will back. Their exit strategy is not when you decide you want to retire. So there may be a differential between expectations and just understanding these various silos of money is essential to making a good plan, targeting your business plan for that funding, and going after it.
For most people, when they look at this, they get very, very intimidated and overwhelmed. And when they are looking at starting something, and even if they work with a number, so many times they'll make projections, and they will look at those projections and say, well, gee whiz, this is the logical thing. This is how I can see it working. This is what can happen. It doesn't make any difference whether you're starting a shop for mechanical repairs or a cookie company, like I said, a hairdressing shop, whatever your business might be. It could even be a small manufacturing facility. This is something that when people are going through that, your book goes into a lot of detail, but one of the things that you bring out is that when people are going to be going in to business, they really have to get down to the bare bones. They have to really look at reality. If someone wanted to start a business, like I said, and this is brand new for them, they might not have a Charles Green in their neighborhood. What would you recommend that they do? Your book is excellent. They could get your book and, you know, get financing now. They could go page by page. But if this still intimidated them, what would you recommend, or who would you recommend as a mentor for this?
Well, I have plenty of feedback saying that the book really explains it in very easy to access, language. So it's not a book about, highfalutin finance and big formulas and stuff. It does break it down into simple language, but basically someone needs to take an inventory of themselves. The fun part is pulling out of the sky this big ambition and this big dream, and we're going to do this great stuff, and we'll build the better mousetrap, and everybody will come to our door, and it's going to be wonderful. We sometimes overlook who else is already providing that service in this market. How do they attract customers? How many customers are they attracting? Is there one competitor? Are there five competitors? What differentiates them, and why is mine going to be better? So you have to be very self-reflective, ask some tough questions, and then think about how much money do you really need for this project. The first place you start is in your own wallet and your own resources, because you have to have a commitment of resources to prove to others that may consider funding you, that you're committed to it as well, with not just your big idea, but also your own contribution to the cost. When you can figure out a realistic set of expectations, we think we can sell 200 widgets a day. We know widgets are going to cost $3 to create. We're going to sell them for $10. And we can cover all of our overhead and our financing cost and still come out with a positive cash flow. When you can really break it down and understand that, you've given someone else information to make a decision. But pie in the sky isn't enough information.
I think that's very true. And I liked what you said about not necessarily going to banks, because there are other options, and we can discuss that. You talk about the micro economy and the macro economy. Would you define the difference between the two?
Sure. The macro economy is a bigger measurement of economic activity. It may be the economy of the United States versus the economy of France. It may be the auto industry or the healthcare industry. Whereas the microeconomy is going to be a much smaller subdivision. It may be the West LA region of the Los Angeles metropolitan area. It may be Bob's Tire Store inside the Compton neighborhood. It's just a smaller subset that you're comparing apples to grapefruits.
You bring out some very good points. One is that every business is connected in today's economy, and that is so true. And sometimes you'll hear people say, gee whiz, we've never had an international economy. Well, as far as I know with history, you go back quite a bit, there has always been a worldwide economy. But as you said, there is this micro economy. And we see it here in Seattle. And one of the biggest companies to affect the economy of the entire state is Boeing. Almost everybody's heard of Boeing. And I can remember when I first came into the area in 1980, there was a great big billboard that was on the side of the road that said, when you leave Seattle, turn out the lights, because Boeing was in a down positioning economically. And the economy in this area was just really, really bad. People couldn't sell their houses. Interest rates were like 18 to 20% if you tried to buy something. It was just awful. That is a major company. Well, the reality was that trickled down. That trickled down. A lot of businesses went out. A lot of businesses that depended on the income from those people that were employed at Boeing, they were gone. It wasn't there. So businesses are connected to each other in ways that many times that people cannot see. And the economy is such a phenomenal weave of interaction. Why do you think it's so hard for people to wrap their minds around that? Is it because we really don't teach people this?
Well, people have different motivations and interpret and filter the news in different ways. This is a great segue to a huge debate going on in our national discourse that can illustrate your point, and that is to whether we should be spending more government money to stimulate the economy or whether we should be cutting the federal budget to lower the deficit and therefore slow down the growth of long-term debt. But if you think about it in a local sense, in Seattle, if your local school board there has to lay off 300 teachers and librarians and band directors and so forth, and then janitors, and make classes go from 24 students to 36 students each, that 300 people who lose their job probably stop and many of them would stop and have a cup of coffee at Seattle's Best or Starbucks every morning on their way to work. All of them went to the grocery store every week. Many of them, if not most, had a meal out at a restaurant at least once a week. They were saving with a local financial planner, putting money away for retirement. When they don't have an income, all of that spending shrinks. So each one of those different businesses loses sales and consequently profits, and they have less money to turn around and spend on what they're spending on. So it becomes a negative cycle that shrinks the economy even more. And that's the relationship between the macro and the micro economy.
Yep, and when you don't have the money to spend, you don't have the money to spend. And that is an instantaneous reality. I have seen that happen through the years in various environments, and one of the strongest lessons that was given to me was in a local grocery store, a chain grocery store. And I went in one day, and it was sort of quiet, and I've come to know some of the employees through the years, and I was asking them, because this was another segment when Boeing and some other businesses were phasing out, they were laying people off right and left, and the work wasn't there, they weren't getting the orders, and I asked them how it was affecting them. They said, well, if you look at our sales sheets, we're selling everything at reduced prices in the deli, all of our high-end cost things we're trying to get rid of because we can't move them quickly enough, people are not spending money. And look at the end of the grocery aisles, and you'll see the hamburger specials, the spaghetti specials, everything that's going to be more of a lower-cost economic feeding of a family. That's what they were focusing on. And I thought, this is fascinating. You watch these things, and you watch how businesses adapt to whatever the economy shifts are. It's quite a phenomena to be able to see. And I really think that you bring a lot of these points out in your book. You talk about a major store, Kroger, that has 2,400 stores nationwide, and what they go through to stay competitive, and they are dealing with food. Everybody has to eat, but you say it's a very brutal environment being in the grocery store business because you have very low margins on what you sell, and you go
and
into a nice description
right.
with that.
And it requires a very high volume because it's very low margin. And what this means to a small business owner is you're a cookie baker who wants to bake mom's special recipe that we all grew up with and we all love, and everyone is crazy about it. But we want to share it with the rest of the world, and we get a couple boxes of these, and we walk up to Kroger and say, we'd like to put these on your shelf. Well, they learn about that competitive nature because Kroger may dedicate three-quarters of one full aisle to cookies. And Nabisco, of course, or General Mills, each have their big bakers, and they each have 50 different brands of cookies because they're going to capture the customer that wants to have a little sandwich cookie with chocolate sandwich, vanilla sandwich, strawberry sandwich. They're going to have chocolate chip. They're going to have raisin. They're going to have coconut. They're going to have all different flavors because what they want to do is sell cookies. And they've got these huge factory bakeries that can make hundreds of different varieties a day, package them up, automated. They can mix it and match it any way you want it, depending on what's selling. You have mom's recipe. It costs you more to bake one box of cookies than it may take these big bakeries, you know, to cook 100.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, you know, you've got to scale that volume. So Kroger is measuring sales per square foot. They don't care if you're selling sandwich cookies, chocolate chip, mom's special recipe. They are concerned about sales per square foot and profits per SKU. So until you convince them, and they'll do some test studies with several hundred products a year, you have to convince them that your product will run off that shelf and produce a profit for them and sales for that store.
It is nothing new, and you bring out some information about demographics, and you were relating it to the grocery store industry, but this really could apply to many, many things. You say you want to find out about household incomes in your area, family composition, ethnicity, education, climate, and this does have a big impact. Now, if you're a mechanic, you might say, well, gee, that doesn't make any difference to me. But it does. If you have 20 other mechanics or shops that offer mechanics within a 5-mile radius, you've got to have some kind of a niche or a specialty that is going to attract people, because that's going to be very competitive.
Absolutely. It's knowing your marketplace. If you are a specialist in working on Mercedes, yet you live in an area where the average household income is under $40,000 a year, it's very likely there aren't many Mercedes households.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the point of that section of the book, is to get small business owners thinking about information, lessons they can learn from Kroger and McDonald's and Wendy's. What did they do right to become so big? Walk through their stores. What are they doing great? What makes this experience terrific? What can I copy? What can I use for free? What lessons have they paid for and they're performing every day that I can emulate in my business to succeed faster? And that's a financial mm-hmm. strategy.
Well, I think that's a great statement. Now, how would one go about getting the demographics? If they were interested in a particular industry and they wanted to, say, let's say, open up this cookie shop in their local environment, they want to have their own particular niche. Now, maybe they need to find out that if they sold their goods to a catering company or catering companies, they might want to have the cookies because they were different from anything else that they'd ever had. Unless they have their own cooks. There's all kinds of ways of looking at things, but let's say that cookie store, someone wanted to open it up and they wanted to develop their own specialty, just like Mrs. Fields started out with. If they were going to do that, where do they go to get the demographics on their area?
Well, there's different kinds of data from different sources, but they could start with their local chamber of commerce to find out maybe how many bakeries there are in that area. They could talk to their state's economic development commission and find out how much food business is done in the state and what parts of the states it's being done in, and how well they're doing. They could go to the U.S. Census Bureau through the web to get an enormous amount of information about every zip code track in their area, to find out the population, the average density of houses, the income averages. Is it young people, old people? And these kinds of data points help you understand how many people you have to sell to in a particular area and how much competition you have. Maybe even whether the state has any incentives for you to help you get started.
Now, what about the Internet, people wanting to do business on the Internet? Is there a different application that someone would need to look at for that?
You're talking about application for credit?
for business. If they wanted to open up a business on the internet, that has been so hot for so many years. A lot of people don't make money. You hear a few stories, and there are more and more success stories relative to working on the internet. But how could you find out about what are the pluses and minuses of doing that?
Well, that's a little more difficult because the information is not as transparent since everyone's got a private business and doesn't have to tell you. But obviously there you do have that chance of building a better mousetrap, and that has to do with building a website that's very easy to navigate and attractive and appealing and if possible unique. It's about search engine optimization where you have several tactics about how to draw more attention to your site, how to get Google to find you easier in your area. There is social media to start pointing people to you and so forth. And many of these investments have a low capital cost, but they have a high time cost. You put a lot of time into pulling those levers and getting that base of information and yourself plugged out there in the web to help people find you.
Very true. Now, let's go back to talking about third-party funding here. There is so much information that you have in this chapter. What would you say to someone that wants to get third-party funding? I really liked the section where you said, don't deal with family. Oh, my goodness. How many times have I talked with people that have involved members of family, and they have just had one nightmare after the other?
Well, that most commonly comes up with banks who think that your balance sheet, your personal net worth may be a little low, but in a small market, they may know you have maybe a parent or an uncle or a close family friend that's got some wherewithal, and so they sort of hang that out there to slap your pride around and just say, if you could get Uncle Joe to borrow this with you, we'll go along with it. And Uncle Joe, of course, would be guaranteeing your credit. The problem and why I advise against that is because, A, you all of a sudden get a new management team member that you didn't go out and recruit and maybe wasn't part of your business plan. Maybe you're putting yourself in the way of a family hierarchy that never went away. Like it's like asking, Dad, can I stay out late after the prom? But in this instance, you're running your business, and Dad is sort of maybe coming in with, you know, this old trapped emotive relationship that overpowers the business relationship, and so your business suffers. And even husband and wives, when you think about if your spouse doesn't have a real interest or ownership or working knowledge about the business, but they have to sign off on the business debt and the marriage falls apart, well, all of a sudden the bank is in the middle of your divorce.
Ouch.
And it becomes somebody to negotiate with. So it just leads to problems, and I always advise people to stay away.
Mm-hmm. One of your comments, and I know we're getting close to our time, would you have a little bit of extra time you could share with me today?
Sure, I can do that.
All right, so we'll continue with this. But their comment, owners need to establish some limits as to what their businesses will agree to, not agree to, and what cost in dollars and conditions they are willing to pay for the financing that they seek. If funders ask for too much, owners should walk away from the deal, reminding themselves why they established the limits they did. They should then look for funding in other places. We're going to be taking a break in just a little bit. So for those of you that are just tuning in, we're talking about how to get financing now. My guest is Charles Green, and his background is in banking. He's been involved with entrepreneurship on many different levels, worked in all kinds of scenarios, and he has just so much information to share. If you know of anyone that is trying to start a business, if you yourself are exploring this, because in this economy that we have that is very erratic, you're saying, gee, I would like to start something on my own, he shared some wonderful tips. We're going to be sharing some more. But you can learn how to navigate through bankers, investors, and various sources for the capital your business needs. So we're going to be going into a little bit more detail when we come back, finding out about too little versus too much money, what do you do, and some other things as well. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Tickets now on sale for the 2012 Conscious Life Expo, February 10th through the 13th at the LAX Hilton. Bringing together an eclectic community of speakers, panelists, exhibitors, artists, and visionaries for a four-day gathering of collective consciousness featuring over 150 workshops, special events, including TV British psychic Lisa Williams and visionary scientist and author Greg Braden, as well as the film festival, live music, Programa Latino, and three exhibit halls packed with healthy products and services. For ticket information, www.consciouslifeexpo.com.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Hi, this is Donna. We're talking with Charles Green in Atlanta, Georgia, and we're talking about financing for a business. Now, for so many people, and Charles is graciously chatting a little bit longer with us, we're talking about third-party financing right now. Now, some of these details may or may not be familiar to you, but if this is something that you know of someone that is perhaps wanting to go into business for themselves, that they need to be aware of. And Charles's book, Get Financing Now, has so many aspects to it. There's just no way that we could cover it all. But funding is extremely important. And we are going to be talking more about how you can get money and what are the various options that you can work with. Charles, thank you for staying with me. Let's go into this third-party funding, because I think that people, when they are looking for money, they're very much focused on what their needs are. But
right.
Let's talk about what the persons that would be putting the money up for, what they're interested in.
Well, whether they're a bank or a finance company or a private investor, they are considering or offering to provide financing for one reason, and that is to make money, to earn a profit of their own. And how much risk they take is going to be determined by where did that money come from. An investor is putting up his own money. He's usually going to be the party that will take the most risk, but it's his money and he can decide to take that risk. Whereas a bank is funding most of their loans, about 95 or 94% of the money you get is actually belongs to depositors, people who have checking accounts and CDs at that bank, and the good old FDIC is indemnifying that depositor. They're making sure it's insured, and the bank is putting it at risk, so they're going to take a very low risk. They're not going to stick their neck out for anyone, and the finance companies kind of come in the middle of that. But just understand, they're in business to make money. They're not going to put their money knowingly on the line that it's going to get lost, and they want it all back.
That and then some. Usually they want something added to it.
Plenty. And we talk in our boot camp about how you have an interest rate that's stated on the loan, but the bank is always going to yield more money than that. They have a lot of interesting ways to calculate the interest rate and to add fees, and sometimes when you make a mistake and you're late, they're going to make more money.
Without question, they're going to be doing that.
Also, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about were angel investors. This is a term that I've met different people through the years where they say they've had an angel investor. This is a private individual that decides to support the business. And what are the pros and cons with this? Because I've known of individuals that have gone into, quote-unquote, arrangements with people, and then they find out they're bounced out. They have a board of directors. They haven't been aware of the fact that the board can decide to eliminate them from the company. I've known of people whose businesses were built up very nicely to the point where they were generating millions and millions of dollars, and then they come into the office one day and they find they're no longer going to be a part of the company. There's a lot of things to pay attention to when you are looking at agreements. True?
Well, that's true, and a lot of what you're describing we talk about as being vulture capitalists. They are often after distressed companies, and that distressed may be a very high rate of growth that's hard to keep funding supplied to, but they may come in and actually use that that desire for funding and that weakness in the borrower's capitalization to take advantage of them and try to do something of a hostile takeover.
Mm-hmm.
Angel capitals are more aptly applied to people who are investing in startup entrepreneurs. They are the first frontier of venture capital of sorts, but they're doing it in small dollar terms. Most angel investments are made between $500,000 and $1,500,000. Much of it is concentrated in the technology field, and they are taking big risk. They're maybe funding some 25 or 30 year old entrepreneur who wants to build a very high tech mousetrap or an application for an iPhone or something that can really do very well to a very big audience in a very short time. And for that, these angels who are taking huge risk with unseasoned business people, they demand or expect and structure their deals for a very high return. But it's because they're taking that high risk. And those very high returns, your business is not paying them like they pay a bank interest. They're paying them by the value of the business itself growing very rapidly, and the ownership interest of that investor grows very rapidly.
There we go. It's absolutely amazing to me all of the variables that can occur in the business environment. And you give some wonderful, wonderful suggestions on what people should do. And I think that when we are looking at doing a business, or if we have a loved one, a friend that's wanting to go into business, understanding all of the variables, dealing with suppliers, prepaid sales, trade credit, the licensing that needs to be done, how you work with cash flow. You cover so many different aspects in the book that I think are just great. How does someone look at the type of financing that would be most appropriate for them? There are people that say, gee whiz, I know I've got my costs, I've got everything out here. I really don't know that I want to deal with a bank. What other options would you recommend to them?
Well, if they're going for something like an asset purchase, you know, equipment, they may look at leasing companies, or there are equipment finance companies. Perhaps they are looking for working capital. They may turn to a receivable financing company or a factor. There's some interesting higher tech alternative financiers online now that I discussed briefly in the book. So there's a growing number of options that are coming out that are opening up the tent and spreading out the different kinds of situations that they finance. If you're in a retail environment, people will actually advance you money that you are expected to collect back with the credit card sales, and they'll actually collect their repayments by the day. But it's based on how many credit card sales you had in the last year. So there are a growing number of alternatives out there.
Well, as we're going through this, and I know we're just about running out of time here, but I would like to know, because you have this institute that you have started, where do people go to find out more about you, what you offer, and also the information regarding education that you yourself are providing to people who are in small business?
Our website is sbfi.org. That stands for Small Business Finance Institute. We are a nonprofit enterprise, and with the ambition, we're building out several channels that people can get these lessons on finance. In Atlanta next month, we're having a long one-day conference with 14 different workshops that cover everything from how to write a good financing proposal to how to get a microloan to how to find an angel investor to how to plan your cash flow. These are all taught by practitioners who do this every day and have been for the last 15 or 20 years. We have a financial boot camp that teaches this book in a two-day workshop. And I know this won't help anyone in Seattle this next week, but our ambition is to bring these programs out across the country and mount them in different cities. We will have a webinar series starting in the month of March that we'd love for people in Seattle to watch out for. Sign up for our mail list, and we continue into opportunities that are coming available.
Well, I know your mission is to foster and develop organizations which create jobs, improve communities, and change lives through successful entrepreneurship and better financial management. Charles Green, this has been really a delight. I really support small business. I'm in that environment myself. My husband has been in business for many, many years. So we have an understanding of what the challenges that people can face. But I think that we're in a time when opportunity looms for many people. And I think having someone like you and people that are associated with a sincere commitment to help the middle class, which to me is the backbone of this nation, I really think that that is a plus. So for those of you listening, you can check out the Small Business Finance Institute. Charles H. Green has been my guest. His book is Get Financing Now. Get the book. Read it. Then you can also go to his website. Check out information there, which is sbfi.org. And, of course, that's the abbreviation for the Small Business Finance Institute.org. Charles, thank you so very much for being with me today.
Thank you, Donna. I enjoyed it.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment with Cliff Fazioli and talking about the life and times of his brother Jeff. We'll be right back.
Tickets now on sale for the 2012 Conscious Life Expo, February 10th through the 13th at the LAX Hilton, bringing together an eclectic community of speakers, panelists, exhibitors, artists, and visionaries for a four-day gathering of collective consciousness featuring over 150 workshops, special events, including TV British psychic Lisa Williams and visionary scientist and author Greg Braden, as well as the film festival, live music, Programa Latino, and three exhibit halls packed with healthy products and services. For ticket information, www.consciouslifeexpo.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. Four out of the last eight Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me. Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Hello, this is Donna Sebo. Welcome back. We have now with us Cliff Fazzolari. Yes. That's a good Italian name. He has this wonderful book, Oh Brother. It's about his own brother, Jeff Fazzolari, his life and times. And Cliff, welcome to the show.
Hi, Donna. It's good to speak with you again.
Yes. Now,
I was
you've
on a
been
few years ago.
Yes, that's right. We've been on my show. Now, you have won all kinds of awards. Now, my audience needs to know that you have written other books. And the one that I remember is Counting on a Miracle. You have a blog where, that you call The Thoughts of a Common Man. But this really, this book about your brother Jeff, comes totally from your heart. And when you did this, when you decided to write the book about Jeff, did you have any idea that it was going to get as much recognition and awards as it has gotten? Tell us what awards you've just gotten.
I just won an award at the New England Book Festival, and no, I had no idea. I actually I wrote the book for his kids and for the rest of my family. I mean, we're a very tight family. You can tell from reading the book, my brothers and sisters, and I mean Jeff was just the integral part of it. He was the walking celebration. He held us all together, and when we lost him, we were devastated. And being a writer, the only thing I knew how to do was kind of write down everything that I wanted to remember. And having published books before, my publisher was kind of on me because she knew I was in a severe depression and funk from losing my best buddy, and she said, well, what have you written this year? I said, nothing, you know. I said, I'm not even sure I want to write anything anymore. And she said, you must have written something, you know. She's like, I know you well enough. I said, well, I wrote some things about my brother that, you know, I wanted to, you know, just to have for future years. And she said, send me that. And, geez, you know, it's 40 pages of garbled nothing, you know. But I sent it along, and the next day I got a contract in the mail to write the book, and she said, you have 30 days. And I was like, that's impossible. She said, all right, I'll give you 60, but I want to see something in 60 days. So, I knew that at that point, I had to do something for my brother and for his children and for the rest of my family, and so I went to work on it, and, the more I got into it, the more I enjoyed remembering things that my brother did, because he was a very funny man, and, I worked hard at making it funny, because I think the one thing he would have said to me is, you know, leave them laughing. So, you know, with that in mind, that's I wrote the book, but I also wrote it in the, you know, with the backdrop of his tragic death. So,
well, he ended up,
yeah.
He ended up having brain bleed. That's what you said in the book. So, he had an aneurysm.
Well, it was a stroke, and it was out of nowhere. I had spoken with him 10 minutes before it happened, and there was no mention of it. We were talking about Bruce Springsteen's new CD, and so, you know, we were both excited. I mean, we were gonna talk again later in the day after we both got a chance to listen to it all the way through, and we never got that chance. 10 minutes later, he just collapsed, and he was a healthy guy, 6'3", 185 pounds. So it was pretty much out of nowhere. And we still, to this day, 3 years later, have no idea why, you know. I mean, and that's the message of the book, is to celebrate your life and to, you know, love with your whole heart and, you know, share everything. And I think that's why the response has been so magnificent. I mean, Jeff is, you know, he's one of them people that just blows through life and like a hurricane force. And a lot of people are, you know, identifying with that type of life and saying, you know, that's the way we should live it, you know. So I think that's why the response has been so magnificent. And, you know, it's a testament to how he lived.
When you wrote this book, as you said, your publicist or your publishing company wanted you to write the story, you ended up really going into a lot of your family history, a lot of information about Jeff. When your family found out that this was something that was being done, did you submit your book to everybody in the family to get their feedback, or did you say, wait until it comes out and then I'll show it to you?
Well, you know, it was pretty much wait till it comes out, and then I'll show it to you, because, you know, we were all so close, and I mean, there's nothing in there to hide. I mean, you know, the love throughout our family is just tremendous, and I knew that they'd back me, and they, you know, why I was writing the story, and, you know, it got everybody's personality into the story, and, you know, it's because that's what we lived in. It was just an honest account of, you know, a wonderful family life. And it's still a wonderful family life. It's just, you know, it's just sadder and it's changed. And, you know, but all my brothers and sisters and my mother, and we talk to each other every day. So,
your father was,
you know,
not your father. Yeah, your brother was a very, very good cook. And there's a photo of you with your brother, and he has on his chef's apron and a chef's cap. And I think that one of the most profound aspects, which is something you have just mentioned, is that life is, and we never know, when someone who is very close to us is going to go. It doesn't make any difference of their age. And not to live life in fear, but to live life with an attitude of, let's take it, today is what we've got, let's work with it, we can make plans, but let's live this day with a sense of joy and purpose. And as you said, you were talking with him 10 minutes later, he's had this stroke, and shortly thereafter, he's gone.
Yeah, and I mean, the one thing about it is, he's really not gone. I mean, it's funny because, you know, you hear that all the time, and the one thing I always tell people is, man, I don't feel the separation. The love feels the same as the day, you know, the day before. It's funny, and I'll say it to people. I do the sign of the cross on a picture of his forehead every morning, and, you know, I kind of tell him what I'm going to do that day, you know, and I can almost... I can hear his voice, you know, answering me, and, you know, he had a very wise way about him, and, you know, I can still laugh with him, you know, and if the Yankees win, I can still share that, and it sounds strange, but even 3 years down the line, I feel as connected as I always have. I just physically don't see him. But I talk to him, and I know he's there, you know.
Well, I do know that you relate one of your experiences where he actually came to you in a dream, one of the many experiences that you've had. And he said to you, "I'm right here. I'll always be right next to you. I'm in the air you breathe. I'm always ready to tickle you." So apparently there was a response on your part in the dream, and he was gone. But I don't make light of it, and I know my listeners wouldn't, because many of us have had experiences similar to yours where we have been aware of someone on the other side reaching out to us and letting us know that they're not really gone. They're just, well, in another frequency, and they are there to support us just like your brother is. Now, Cliff, for people that want to find out about your blog, Thoughts of a Common Man, your wonderful book, Oh Brother, The Life and Times of Jeff Fazzolari, how would they get in touch with you? What is your website?
FazzolariBooks.com, so that's spelled out F-A-Z-Z-O-L. ARIbooks.com. And one of the things I did for this book was I wanted to personally sign Jeff's message into each copy. And, you know, it sounded good at the beginning, but and it still is. And I've signed every copy of the book that I've sent out. So I actually have people send me an email. I send the book out with the signed autograph on it, and then now it will get a sticker that says it's a New England Book Festival winner. And all I have to do is send me an email, and I send it out with an invoice.
Well, and it's
worked.
That's wonderful.
So my email address, my email address is cliffordfc@roadrunner.com.
All right, cliffc@roadrunner.com. Cliff, I'm out of time, and I'm going to have to say goodbye to you and to my listeners. Thank you so much for being with me today. For those of you who are listening, tomorrow's a Quantum Mind 2 class. Hope to see you there. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Enjoy your day, your evening, wherever you might be, and we'll be back with you right here at bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.